KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
Our liberation is embracing our cultural foods. I think that's a very important part. Spiritually, physically, and otherwise, we have to be embracing these foods because it's our birthright. They were there for us and they've sustained us through the roughest times. And I think they will be a powerful way to address this exponential rise in preventable diet-related illnesses that we see in our communities.
When we left the land, we lost our power. We lost who we are. And I tell people of color, look at the color of your skin because the color of your skin is soil.
Ooh.
And when you look at the color, when I put my hands in that soil, Brian, baby, and I look at that brown skin, I say, hello, ancestors. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And we got to start thinking about that and start embracing us. Embracing us together. Don't let people separate us.
In this episode, we hear from Karen Washington and Bryant Terry on how the Black Food Movement is weaving the threads of a rich African agricultural heritage with the liberation of economics from an extractive corporate food oligarchy. The results can be health, conviviality, community wealth, and the power of self-determination. I'm Neil Harvey. This is Black Food, Liberation, Food Justice, and Stewardship. Like other foundational contributions to American culture, the influences of Africans and Black Americans on food and agriculture have been variously erased, scorned, and belittled. African American agrarian history is doubly complicated by its intimate association with the trauma of slavery. Africans who were violently forced into captivity and brought to the Americas to power the plantation economy were highly skilled farmers with expertise in agriculture founded in ancestral African knowledge. Their traditions were ones of shared labor, worker co-ops, and botanical polycultures. At the heart of their worldview was reverence for the sacredness of the earth. Across centuries of enslavement, African-descended people survived savage injustice and suffering. When slavery ended, Black farmers were able to purchase nearly 16 million acres of land. Today, almost all of that is gone, the result of stolen lands, terrorism, and structural racism, including by U.S. government programs. The modern U.S. Department of Agriculture has been legally found to have discriminated against Black farmers on a mass scale. These burdens of history are the context for today's radical health disparities between Black and white communities, including an epidemic of diet-related diseases. But renowned urban farming trailblazer Karen Washington says it's time to overcome those burdens of history and remember the deeper African-American lineage.
So it starts by understanding your history. I grew up in an era where farming was equivalent to slavery. And now that's starting to change because when the elders speak to young people, they say, you know why we were brought here enslaved? We were brought here because of our knowledge of agriculture.
Right.
We weren't brought here because we were dumb or strong. We were brought here because we had agriculture in our blood. We were an agrarian people. We brought seeds in our hair to feed this country. And when you start talking to Black and brown people, all of a sudden they understand the power that they have, their connection to food.
Inspired by a rich African agrarian heritage, Karen Washington sees food justice as a seminal space to uplift Black communities holistically. She's been recognized by Ebony Magazine as one of the 100 most influential African Americans, and the New York Times referred to her as urban farming's de facto godmother. As a tireless advocate for the economic empowerment of communities of color, she's a powerful force for creating the conditions for people of color to have equal access to health, distributed wealth, and power. Karen Washington spoke at a Bioneers conference.
For so long, the negativity that has been instilled in our head with our relationship to food, when the truth comes up, and also when it's spoken from the elders who knew about farming, knew about the history, it changes. And then all of a sudden, people say, you know what? I want to be in the game. I want to understand my relationship to food. Because all around me, I see the diet-related disease, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, obesity that's happening. But yet they'll tell you, my grandparent lived to 100 years of age because they ate the food from the earth. And so again, talk about your history, that rich cultural history, bring it up to the surface so that people around are now proud of that history and proud of their relationship to food and who they are.
You know, I always talk about the idea of Sankofa, this West African concept of, you know, looking backwards as we move forward and bringing with us the best practices and traditions.
Bryant Terry grew up in the South, where he worked in his grandfather's diverse urban garden. They grew grapevines, nut trees, and a variety of vegetables, along with raising chickens and pigs. At the time, he hated weeding, harvesting, and shucking corn and peas. Now he looks back in appreciation of the life lessons he learned at that backyard garden in Memphis. Bryant Terry went on to author landmark books bridging traditional African-American foods with veganism. But, he says, food is about a lot more than food.
And I knew, coming from these strong middle-class Black communities, going to Atlanta and Chicago and Georgia and other parts of the country and visiting Black folks, that, you know, one, my first encounter with this idea of veganism came from Seventh-day Adventists, Black Seventh-day Adventists in my community. And then in high school, when I had to go through my obligatory, after reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, my obligatory obsessive period with the Nation of Islam, I learned about Honorable Elijah Muhammad, How to Eat to Live, 2-book collection that talked about the rejection of the standard American diet and embracing like foods that are for healing in life. We could talk about Rastafarians and the Ital diet. We could talk about comedians, Dick Gregory, his activism around food and health issues. We could talk about, I mean, the impetus for me even like shifting my whole habits and attitudes and politics around food was hearing the song Beef by Blastmaster KRS-One and Boogie Down Productions, a hip-hop song that talked about factory farming.
Beef, what a relief. When will this poisonous product cease? This is another public service announcement. You can believe it or you can doubt it. Let us begin now with the cow, the way it gets to your plate and how. The cow doesn't grow fast enough for man.
Research has shown a direct link between diet and disease. Due to a severe lack of access to healthy foods and easy access to the standard American diet of highly processed carbohydrates, unhealthy fats, and sugar, Black Americans suffer disproportionately from diet-related disease compared to whites. At the same time, racist attitudes have disparaged traditional African and African-American foods that have sustained Black people through centuries of struggle and privation.
In the spirit of anti-Blackness, everything we do is vilified, you know, including our food. And we know historically and contemporarily, it's not just the wider culture. It's even, this is the thing that hurts and upsets me and why I write books and why this book is so important, because it's even people of African descent, Black folks, who will be talking about our food as slave food. Oh, that's, you know, vilify and talk so negatively about our historical and cultural foods. And I'm not going to deny things like chitlins and pig's feet and, you know, whatever, the kind of discarded parts that plantation owners might force many enslaved Africans to eat. that's about ingenuity and creativity and making the best what people had. So that's one part. But then the other one is that when people talk about black food, they're imagining the big flavored meats and the overcooked vegetables and the sugary desserts that you find at a soul food restaurant, right? I'm not denying that red velvet cake and mac and cheese and ribs and whatever is, but what about collards, mustards, turnips, kale, dandelions, sugar snap peas, pole beans, black eyed peas, sweet potatoes, butternut squash, kale? These are our traditional foods. These are the type of foods that have sustained people for generations. And we can't leave this out of conversation because it's been intentionally erased. You know, these are the type of foods that any Western-trained allopathic physician, nutritionist, or dietitian would say we should all be eating. Collard foods is black superfoods. You know, they have, they're high in A, C, and E. They have a lot of anti-cancer-fighting compounds. Okra, which is like one of the king staples of black foodways coming from the continent and spreading out, it helps to lower blood pressure. So our liberation is embracing our cultural foods. I think that's a very important part. Spiritually, physically, and otherwise, we have to be embracing these foods because it's our birthright. They were there for us and they've sustained us through the roughest times. And I think they will be a powerful way to address this exponential rise in preventable diarrhea-related illnesses that we see in our communities.
Food at its essence is nourishment. It's health and well-being. It's family and community and culture. It's a daily thanksgiving to the earth and ancestors. Then again, it's one thing to embrace cultural foods and food culture, yet how do you do that within a fundamentally extractive, commodified, and intensely monopolized food economy? Again, Karen Washington.
And if we look at the food system closely, we can see that it's in like four quadrants. There's a production, there's a processing, there's a distribution, and there's a consumption. On one hand, you have the movers and the shakers being the policymakers and climate change. The other side is the movers, labor and energy, and waste is being fueled by land and resources. But if you look at those four quadrants, what is the common denominator that you see? It's labor. This land that we are on was built on the backs of indigenous and enslaved people. And that even today, our food system, again, is being built on labor from prisons. And now it's the migrant workers that are providing the cheap labor in this country. And you wonder why there's such a disconnect of people trying to understand where their food comes from, trying to feed their family, when for so long the food system is supposed to be helping those people, but instead it's exploiting them. And so for me, it's about shifting of power. The way the food system is going to change is shifting the power from those who for so long had power over others back into the hands of the community.
We can't just talk about food in isolation, because what our industrialized food system has done is created it as a commodity. And then you have this huge chasm where so many of the things that have been traditionally so integral to the way that we grow food and cook it and eat it, like art, like culture, like community, like building around the table, like growing food in a sustainable way, like feeling like we can do it in a communalistic way and not in this individualistic capitalist way. My work through books, through activism, through talking has been about reintegrating that so that we can have all those things in concert with each other, because it's not just about food, it's just this fuel, it's about life, it's about, you know, connection, it's about love, it's about all these things that capitalism has stripped it of.
Bryant Terry is constantly seeking ways to counter this shrink-wrapped racial capitalism that dominates the food economy. At a high tide of racial reckoning in 2020, he was inspired by reading Toni Morrison's book celebrating black culture, titled The Black Book. In it, Morrison wanted to explore this provocative question: what would your life be without racism? Bryant Terry decided to pose that question to black cultural leaders and ask them to share family recipes and stories for his book, Black Food. It was going to be published at an epic moment when the movement for black lives was becoming the biggest and most diverse in American history. Publishers were scrambling to fabricate a more inclusive, anti-racist image. Bryant Terry seized the moment.
This book came on the heels of in 2020 when we were as a country dealing with this, what people describe as a racial reckoning, really looking inward and facing the realities of how we have treated Black folks, people of African descent, other folks of color, but specifically Black folks, because this was coming on the heels of the state murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And in the midst of that, there was a revelation of a lot of racism in food media. I don't know if y'all are aware of this, but there are some legacy food magazines that were being called out for their racist behavior, their failure to support their employees of color, the mistreatment of many of their Black and other folks of color employees. And then there were some publishing companies. It was revealed that they were doing some horribly racist things to some of their authors as well as employees. And one of my friends, I literally learned about just the horrible way in which this major publisher in New York City treated her and practically tried to erase her from her book because she co-authored with a white woman. And they thought that the white woman would be a better face of the book than this, you know, heavyset Black woman. For me, it was a moment where this book that I had been thinking about putting together for years, when I contacted all the contributors or potential contributors, what I told them is that you can't write a book like this without touching on the ways in which Black people have been exploited and marginalized and erased. That's just a reality that we know we contend with all the time. And I feel like so many of the books that are talking about our realities do focus on our struggles and focus on our historical marginalization and oppression. And we know about these realities, so we don't have to talk about it to each other because we're aware of it. And one of the things that I was clear about is that this book, I wanted it to be created without concern for the white gaze. I wanted this to be about Black people speaking to each other, having conversations about our deep connection to food and about our different food ways and how they've developed throughout the globe. And of course, we want to invite the world in to be a part of the conversation, but we're not modifying. We're not trying to like make it pretty. We're just speaking about our realities. I'm just going to be like real with you all. When everything was going down with the racial reckoning, with a lot of these companies and corporations, they were embarrassed. And they were invested in repairing reputational harm. And I was trained as a historian. I've seen this before. And I was very clear that there was going to be this period in which these companies were working really hard to repair reputational harm. And they're going to be doing everything to make Black folks happy or perform their kind of like solidarity with Blackness or whatever it looked like. And I was clear that that door was going to be open. And then it was going to shut again. And I wasn't clear about how long it was going to be. And it's been interesting because I have been talking about, yeah, you know, I feel like the door is shutting. And I was in Philadelphia at this conference. Korsha Wilson is this journalist based in New Jersey. She wrote a big profile of me in the New York Times. And we were in conversation. And I brought up the fact that I felt like the door was closing. And she said it's already closed. You know, she talked about in 2020 how she was getting like an avalanche, a waterfall of like, you know, jobs from magazines and newspapers. And this is a respected, seasoned journalist. And she said it slowed down to a trickle. So imagine those up and coming budding writers who are trying to do this work and get into like, you know, food media. And so what I was clear about with my agent is that this is a moment to grab power. This is a moment where we need to move beyond just being rewarded as talent, which often happens. You know, when I first started publishing, the first thing, when I got my first contract and I talked to my parents about it, the first thing my dad said to me is like, you know, son, I'm proud of you. Penguin Random House is a reputable publisher, and I'm glad they're going to put your book out. But let me just say this, and I want you to remember this always. You need to think like Master P. This is, I don't know if y'all know who Master P is. He's an older rapper and entrepreneur, but for the younger people. But, you know, he was one of these pioneers where he was just like, look, it's not just about making music. It's about ownership. It's about creating your own label. It's about controlling. It's about self-determination. And so in many ways, now that I have my publishing imprint, sure, it's still under Penguin Random House. But like, honestly, I'm looking at it as like a prestigious and well-paid internship, because the goal for me is to learn about the internal logic, the structure, the like the way that publishing operates so that I can eventually have my own independent publishing company and not even have to rely on like, you know, some big multinational corporation doing the work.
Bryant Terry has received the James Beard and NAACP Awards for his writing and activism. He's currently the chef in residence at the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco, where he also creates public programming at the intersection of food, farming, health, activism, art, and culture. When we return, can a broken food system that systematically disadvantages low-income communities actually be transformed? Can community-based wealth creation challenge the concentration of corporate power over our food? And how do we begin to build a more just economic system and a healthier food system? It comes down to power. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers. You can visit bioneers.org to subscribe to our newsletters and podcasts. Check out deep dives on the topics that matter to you most and learn about our events. That's bioneers.org. Access to healthy, affordable food is a basic human right. Yet 34 million people in the U.S. suffer from food insecurity, in other words, hunger. Black households experience food insecurity at almost 3 times the rate of white families. The term food desert is used to describe the countless communities where healthy food is flat out unavailable. But Karen Washington says food desert is an outsider term imposed on communities which have been held back by structural racism. She has instead coined the term food apartheid. It signifies the institutional inequities that result in poverty, hunger, and lousy food access. Just bringing in a food store to these communities doesn't change the underlying causes of injustice.
7.8 billion people on this earth, but a handful of companies control the food, the water, the land, the seeds. And we sat back and let it happen. We become so complacent and so silent. And yet a handful, predominantly white men, control the food system of 7.8 billion people on this planet. When do we wake up to grab our power? Where is the urgency for us to collectively? I talk about social capital and communal wealth. I don't want a hand out. I want a hand in. The system has to change so that we have the power to make decisions within our own community. But we're not doing that. We sit back and let politicians and other outside organizations make change for us. The time is now for us to start coming together collectively. Collectively to shift the power back into our hands, and we can do it.
Two companies now control 40% of global seed sales. Three companies control over 50% of the grocery sales. The food system is one big monopoly board. From seed to grocery shelf, corporate consolidation stands against the ability of communities to produce, process, and distribute healthy, affordable, culturally appropriate food. Karen Washington and Bryant Terry both call for a shift of power into the hands of local communities.
The things that we often look at when we talk about health, food, and farming issues is the things that I think are seemingly apolitical, like growing food, like cooking meals, like building around the table and eating with people in our formal and informal kinship networks. These are highly political, dare I say radical, in a food system that's controlled by 5 multinational food corporations that largely control our food system. They don't want us growing our own food. They want us buying their crappy food that they're producing on, you know, these big farms. They don't want us cooking. They don't want us deepening our cooking practice because they want us buying their ready-made processed packaged foods, fast foods. And I'm not blaming the victim, because structurally I understand why people are going to fast food restaurants and getting industrialized foods. But what I'm saying is that in the face of that, doing things like making, growing your own food in rural areas and urban areas, making meals from scratch, building around the table, they want us eating our food in our car over our sink when we leave one low-paying job to the next low-paying job. So I think that it's important to understand that these are radical acts of resistance that we can do on a daily basis. And I think that cooking is a very powerful and radical act where we can exert our agency over how we feed ourselves.
Karen Washington says that as crucial as food pantries and soup kitchens are for people's survival, they're also part of the problem because they're baked into the system.
Folks, it's emergency purposes only. It's not people's way of living. And I tell the nonprofits, get out of the way and let people start thinking about self-sufficient and self-reliant. And that means having the economic power of thinking about social capital and communal wealth. Teaching people how to flourish in terms of economics, financial education, entrepreneurship, owning their own businesses, having money and resources that are being made by the community coming back into the community, and teaching communities the power of giving and loving and sharing.
To build a food system with those values, Karen Washington and a group of fellow New Yorkers developed a plan to empower those at the very heart of the food system. It's called the Black Farmers Fund. Instead of waiting for the government, the fund is designed to empower and support economic development, entrepreneurship, jobs, ownership, and community wealth building. But Washington also believes we need to rethink the very concept of ownership that led us to this predicament.
And I'd rather say, instead of saying ownership, we should say stewards. Because that's where we are. We're stewards of the land, because I don't believe you can own anything. You don't live long enough on earth to own anything. Yeah. You know, why is it that we're always trying to go against nature instead of working with nature? But if you say that you want land so you can steward the land, so that you can work with nature, so that the land is an element that's part of this whole ecosystem, then it makes sense. And it's not threatening because you're not grabbing it to hold on to it. You're using it as a way to preserve this ecosystem that we're all part of. When we left the land, we lost our power. We lost who we are. And I tell people of color, look at the color of your skin, because the color of your skin is soil.
Ooh.
And when you look at the color, when I put my hands in that soil, Brian, baby, and I look at that brown skin, I say, hello, ancestors. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And we got to start thinking about that and start embracing us together. Don't let people separate us. Think about us collectively as a group of power. We stand on the shoulders of kings and queens. And I tell my young people sometimes, when your crown is crooked, go in that mirror and make sure that crown is straight, because you are the remnants of kings and queens on this earth.
Wow.
Karen Washington and Bryant Terry. Black food. Liberation, food justice, and stewardship. Executive producer Kenny Ossibel. Written by Kenny Ossibel and Artie Mangan. Senior producer and station relations, Stephanie Welch. Program engineer and music supervisor, Emily Harris. Host and consulting producer, Neil Harvey. Producer, Teo Grossman. Production assistants, Monica Lopez. Additional music by Ketsa. I'm Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 257.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
A few years ago, when COVID restrictions were hampering retail trade everywhere, the owner of the George's Street Arcade in Dublin, Gwen Layden, allowed her tenants to hold off on paying their rent. When universal restrictions ended, stallholders could pay in phases while their bruised businesses picked up. And when, a couple of years later, the first Ukrainians arrived in Ireland as refugees from war at home, Gwen Layden offered to help again by covering the rent, insurance and start-up costs of a stall in the market. As a student in the late 80s and 90s, I was a regular in the arcade. We all were, kicking about in our giant boots, waiting for someone to introduce us to self-esteem and the mobile phone. It was free to covet the vintage silk taffetas and ropes of beads in Jenny Vander, to open and click closed the handbags of hardened leather. Marx Brothers sandwiches were not free, but they were accessibly cheap. They came with mugs of boiled coffee and the right to linger in the basement, wallpapered in hand-lettered gig posters. The spirit of Marx Brothers lived on until last year in another cafe, Simon's Place. But to thrive, arcade life develops and moves on, and today's newer stalls and shops are as many and various as ever. A juice bar, a psychic, a body piercer. Rare, the K-pop shop one of my nieces introduced me to. Megan Maguire's Seeking Judy knitwear and bags, as seen in the pages of Vogue. The ornate red brick market is vast, built as the South City Market in 1881 to occupy an entire block bounded by George's Street, Exchequer Street, Drury Street and Fade Street. In the 1880s, the central market hall was home to about 25 stalls, confectioners, greengrocers, butchers, shellfishmongers. Large shops, cafes, dressmakers, hotels and restaurants occupied the perimeter and opened into the surrounding streets. But while the South City Market was still a relatively new feature of the city, the arcade was all but destroyed. In the early hours of the 27th of August, 1892, a fire broke out in the market hall and whipped up towards Drury Street, pulling stall after stall into its blaze. It tore through shops until tongues of fire burst through rooftops and windows. People stumbled from bed and ran into the air in their nightclothes. Others were roused and rescued by strangers. A dazed, terrified crowd watched as the men of the Dublin Fire Brigade, directed by Thomas Purcell, tried to bring the fire under control. They stopped it from igniting the thousands of barrels of whiskey in the Powers bonded warehouse, but the stalls were lost and many of the other businesses were gutted. Astonishingly, there was not a single death. That hot August week was horse show week, and with an eye to the country customers flooding into the city, Elizabeth Kenny had bought in extra stock for her fruit stall. In fact, she said, her stock was the largest I had this season, and I generally had a very large one. None of the beautiful fruit she had sourced to tempt the horse show visitors survived. Her prize grapes, Spanish melons, pineapples and luscious peaches were gone, along with the humbler potatoes and peas. Also gone for good were the fixtures and equipment essential to her business. Shelves and countertop, scales and measures, bags and baskets. Even her account books, ledgers and files were burned. She knew that her credit customers owed her about £200, but the proof of that was in ashes. There were some huge losses that night. £20,000 worth of stock and damage in the case of Pym's furniture warehouse, but at least they were insured. Others lost less in financial terms, but if it was everything you owned, the loss was far greater. Lucy Conlon had been living and working in Warren's Hotel on the corner of George's Street and Exchequer Street. A couple of days after the fire, she wrote, "I was one of the servant girls in Warren's Hotel. I escaped in my nightdress. My box with all I had was consumed, which leaves me destitute and without means to purchase clothes to procure a situation." Anna Mangan, a florist with premises at 29 Drury Street, told a similar story. She and her four children escaped in their nightclothes and nothing was saved. "I am utterly ruined," she wrote, "without even a bed to lie on, the clothes that are covering us being borrowed." How were people to recover? The Lord Mayor of Dublin quickly established a relief fund, and chunky contributions materialised from well-known commercial names like Arnott's, Powers, Jemison, Guinness and Jacobs. Plenty of smaller businesses and compassionate fellow citizens contributed too, and a committee assessed applications for assistance. Elizabeth Kenny was given £60 to cover the costs of setting up another fruit stall from scratch. Lucy Conlon was granted £3 to buy clothes so that she could apply for another job. Anna Mangan and her family were given £135 to cover their domestic and commercial losses. Between 60 and 70 of the market community were helped. Over £1,000 was distributed. The market was rebuilt and reopened just 2 years after the fire and has operated ever since as home to a dynamic population of independent traders. The skill and bravery of those who fought the fire and the generosity of those who donated to the relief fund enabled Dubliners to spin a good news story from a disaster. Well over a century on, those rent reductions during COVID and stall space for wartime refugees suggests that the Georgia Street Arcade Market is still a community, still somewhere to find good news amid bad.
No, I don't believe I'm an angel. Troubles push me to fall, nor that you could have saved me from God or anything at all.
I've seen so much rain in my time, but the time I recall most clearly is when I was at sea as a young officer. I was a newly promoted second officer, and I was on a Merchant Navy cargo passenger vessel in the South Atlantic, coming from New Orleans, bound for Auckland. It had rained for days, downpours with no let-up. Vicious freezing rain, so unlike the monsoon rains that bucket down, but at least they're warm. But down in the South Atlantic, with no other ship around, and no sign of land for miles, it rained hard and bitterly cold for days. When the first officer was handing over watch to me, "Keep an eye on the glass," he said. "It's falling. We're heading into something nasty. We should reduce speed until the glass starts to rise." I'll talk to the old man, meaning the captain, and I thought he'll ignore that advice. Then came the wind. Before my watch had finished, ragged clouds started to race across the darkening sky, developing into Gale 8, then Storm 10, then Severe Storm 12. Our engine was a Doxford type with 8 units or cylinders, and they were being closed down by the engineers, one after another, due to scavenge fires caused, we later discovered, by excessive sulphur content in an inferior fuel oil taken on at our last port of call. Eventually, there were only 2 units working, and the storm was getting worse. A bleak time ahead, with the engineers working flat out to keep the 2 remaining units working, with, as I have said, no other ships around. But what made it bleaker was the captain. He started to panic. He was always a nervous and unsure man who'd drop anchor 2 or 3 times before he was satisfied whenever we had to drop anchor. But sitting with the passengers at mealtimes, he was in his element. He was nice enough on a fine day, but wasn't cut out for bad news or bad times or pressure. Already we had lost all deck cargo, 6 John Deeres, 4 excavators and numerous drums of oil, all washed overboard, and the storm showed no sign of letting up. The captain was wandering around the ship, telling whoever would listen to him, with a shrill voice, that we were finished, and done for, as he put it. You can imagine what effect this had on the crew. Even at best of times, one of them was always liable to cut loose, as they always felt they were being kept in the dark about good or bad news. Now fear percolated down to the cabin boy. As the storm raged on and the captain staggered about with his tale of woe, the first officer came to me. This was a very quiet man, taciturn even, a man who never made a fuss, didn't care which way his eggs were boiled, hard or soft. That about sums him up, but in every way sound and reliable. He stood beside me and, as if he was just passing the time of day, remarked, "We'll lock him up. Do you agree?" I agreed. I was with him. We approached the captain. "You'd better come along with us," was all that the first officer said, and we led the way, with difficulty in the heaving storm, to the ship's hospital. The captain followed us without a word. He seemed, if anything, relieved as the three of us stumbled along the corridor to the hospital cabin. We opened the door. He walked inside and made no comments or protest as we turned the key. The first officer didn't say anything about assuming command. He just turned around to face the storm again, and eventually, with great difficulty and skill, he was able to bring the ship's head about into the wind, which showed how strong it was, as we were now doing 3 or 4 knots astern or backward. The storm raged on for another 9 hours, and when it finally veered off and petered out, we were drained, but we felt safe again. The old moon came out slicing through the sooty clouds and shone down and seemed to say, "Don't blame me. You are safe now." We released the captain, who promptly returned to the bridge. He never said a word about what we'd done, and we never made an entry in the ship's log regarding the incident. Did the captain mention it in the captain's log? I'll never know. I was to meet that first officer once again some years later down in Lourenço Marques in Mozambique. We sat in the sunshine at a table and had a quiet beer together, but, true to character, he never mentioned anything about our quiet mutiny. It was as if it had never happened. A quiet mutiny by a quiet man in a loud and raging sea. After a time, we said goodbye and went our separate ways, but leaving him that sunny afternoon in sunny Mozambique, I thought surely it burned in his memory as it did mine, that strange encounter between the captain, the first mate and me, down in the rain in the South Atlantic Sea.
I lost my hip in San Martino. It wasn't the one I was born with, of course, those hips are long gone. At 26 years of age, they gave me 2 new ones in spanking titanium steel, a joy to behold, a miracle of modern engineering. When I looked at the x-rays afterwards, I saw 2 curved shafts orbited by wires that looked like the tracks of electrons in those representations of atoms we studied at school. I was proud of them. They cost me a lot in sleepless nights and pain, but I remember the surgeon saying to me, "You'll never have pain in your hips again," and he was right. Even when, 42 years later, one of them failed, I had no pain. My daughter-in-law, a physiotherapist, told me that there was so much scar tissue around the broken joint that it held me upright. But I was convinced I had pulled a muscle badly and needed to walk more. So I spent a week walking around Italy, going out with friends, going to a concert, a book launch, taking the evening passeggiata, all on a broken hip. In the end, the penny dropped. I was taken by ambulance to the Ospedale Policlinico San Martino, one of the biggest and best hospitals in Europe, the main public hospital for the city of Genoa and the Liguria region. When the doctor in the emergency department saw the x-ray, she said, "I've never seen this model of hip before. Do you know anything about it?" As it happens, my son had once been a curator in the Science Museum in London, and they had one there, and I could ask him. He texted me back a few minutes later with the technical data. The doctor took one look at it and burst out laughing. "I've read about it in the history books," she said, "but I never thought I'd actually see one." This was the pattern of my encounters at San Martino. The primario, the consultant, as we would say, told me they would need to research the hips and buy in special instruments for the operation, and it would take time. All the members of his team were excited at the thought of operating on a piece of archaeology, a historical artifact. I suspect they were all thinking of writing a paper for a learned journal. I can imagine the title: Medical Archaeology, Excavating a 42-Year-Old Hip. Even the nurses and the physio wanted to know all about it. I was a curiosity, even in a hospital well used to foreigners and their skiing accidents and car accidents and cycling accidents. I should say that I was in a ward specialising in complex traumatic orthopaedic surgery. In a hospital that large, the specializations are very specialized. How was my stay in San Martino? Confined to the bed for a week before the operation, I slowly got to know the ways of an Italian hospital. For example, I learned that mealtimes coincided with visiting times, a completely natural coincidence for Italy, because who would want to eat alone when they could eat with family and friends? The food, though, was especially terrible, a shocking fact in a land where food is life. It all came in sealed plastic containers, fresh from the hospital-sized microwave, and it was all equally inedible. How did I find being in hospital in a part of Italy where almost nobody speaks English? Fine. Firstly, because everybody was very kind and praised me for, as they often said, speaking Italian better than themselves. A typical piece of Italian courtesy extended to beginner and expert alike. And secondly, because all medical and scientific terminology is more or less derived from Latin anyway, more or less the same in English and Italian, with the addition or subtraction of a vowel here and there. There were a few major cultural differences. For example, the nurses were shocked that I liked to sleep with my feet outside the blankets. I had to make an argument for it every night. Eventually, one nurse rationalized it. She had been working there for almost 30 years, she told me, and in that time she had noticed that la gente del nord, the people of the north, all slept with their feet out. It was strange, but obviously an ancient tradition in that part of the world. And how did the operation go? Well, I was asleep, so I can't say for sure, but for me it was easy. The primario said it took longer than they expected, but they were happy with it. And the recovery has been easy. As I write, I now have a 3-month-old hip and a 42-year-old hip. The old one is fine for now, they say. The original surgeon told me he hoped it would last 20 or even 25 years. So why did it last so long? According to my son, it was made of Soviet titanium. They made things last back in those days. Gorbachev was General Secretary of the Communist Party, and he had an interest in steel, as an Italian engineer who knew him once told me. Unfortunately, it has outlasted both Gorbachev and the Soviet Union itself. I liked old Gorby. I don't think Putin is making hips like that, whatever else he's at.
It's not easy to photograph the shark-like fish known as the flapper skate. At 3 meters wide, wingtip to wingtip, it's a challenge to fit one inside the shot, especially when you're on a small boat, legs backed against wet fiberglass, abandoning your upper body to the air. When leaning any further back, will likely topple you into the Irish Sea. But we're jumping ahead. To photograph a flapper skate, first, you need to catch one. It was mid-June and the sea was unusually still. a flat cam, or in technical terms, a sea state zero. The boat was the Wee Gem, and in it my companions Ronald and Ian were cramming tackle boxes next to oilskins and lunch bags. I wobbled on board and felt, I can't help but say it, out of my depth. I was the marine biologist for this trip, and supposedly the expert among us, but I hadn't even been on a boat for 5 years. Ronald and Ian were the anglers, the ones who spent every possible minute on the water, the ones who knew where to find the skate. We headed northeast towards the Maidens, a collection of islets off the Antrim coast and a good place, Ronald said, to catch bait. On the way, I showed him the first skate images returned from sea long before photography. In a 16th century hoax, skate bodies were deliberately deformed, dried, and brought ashore by sailors claiming they had found angels, demons, or monsters. The true story of the flapper skate is less magical. It's a story of overfishing, population collapse, and desperate conservation attempts. I clutched my camera and watched the swell rise. We were hunting the largest skate in the world, in one of the last places they were believed to survive. A photograph could help to confirm that, providing evidence that they were not yet lost from this coast. The image I was after had paperwork behind it, declarations to the government about the experience of each person on board, certificates of training in handling techniques. There are so few flapper skate left that you must hold a license even to photograph one. The day passed gently. Seals rose around us, watched us for a while, and slipped away. The boat rocked on low waves, and occasionally we moved position. By early evening, we were at our third skate mark, the name given to fishing sites where skate are often found. The other marks, it seemed, had been empty. Ian threw back an undersized mackerel and we decided to go home. That is when we noticed the skate rod bending absurdly towards the water. Ian grabbed the harness. An adult flapper skate can weigh over 100 kilograms, about the same as a baby elephant. Its jaws are designed to crush shell and can remove a finger just as easily. While Ronald secured Ian to the boat, he explained to me that landing the skate could take a full 20 minutes. It seemed longer. I watched the grey waves and the quivering rod. I watched Ian's face, intent and strained. I waited for the line to break and the monster, the angel, to dissolve into the dark sea. Then a glimmer underwater, something pale metres from the surface rising towards us. The skate seemed composed, stately even, and for a moment I regretted our intent to extract her, though only briefly, in the name of scientific endeavour. And yet, if the skate population had been healthier, we would not have been there. The species is classed as critically endangered. The next stage is extinct in the wild. Time was tight. It took both men to carry the skate on deck, and the second she was there, I got to work, measuring, scribbling down frantic numbers. I grabbed my camera and began backing towards the side of the boat. She didn't fit in the viewfinder, so I edged back again until I was as far as I could go, then I leaned back some more over the gunwale. The skate lay calmly on the deck, her long nose towards the camera, her eyes dark and still. A few clicks, another with Ian sitting by her tail. Then arms were under her, slowly lifting, and she was lowered back into the sea. The skate floated at the surface briefly, then with a flick and a flash of white, she was gone. The boat turned towards the coast and I scanned through the image thumbnails. Me, one hand placed on her wing, the other holding a tape measure. Ian crouching by her tail, grinning madly. The skate, alone on the deck, the end of each wing just inside the frame. Photographs for campaigning, photographs as trophies, but most importantly, photographs as data, as evidence of an all but mythic creature which, thanks to the efforts of local anglers, may now not be lost.
There's a cockstep coming into the evenings. An optimist by nature, my grandmother liked making this pronouncement each year. She was referring to the extra light in the sky as we move from winter solstice towards spring brightness. She could feel that stirring in the air, something very faint and very subtle but nonetheless tangible. She knew the clockwork belly of the earth was shifting, gathering its breath, somewhat like the movement of a timepiece as it prepares to strike the hour. The creep is gradual, but she was attuned to it. When I think about her now, she might rightly be described as a wise woman. Minimally educated, yet she observed the world about her with great curiosity, marvelled at its complexity, and thus came to a heightened understanding of nature. Anyone who has observed the arrogant strut of a cockerel in a hen run will know the length of a cockstep and easily equate it to the glide of evening light as measured by my grandmother. She read the weather by assaying the smoke from her chimney. High pressure signalled by straight emissions and low pressure when the same smoke fell to the ground. Rain on the way if there were caps of cloud on distant Slieve na Mon, and thus no point in hanging sheets on the line. She was also an observer of the moon and its cycles. I marvelled how she would suggest seed sowing in conjunction with its phases. This is a time of year when I like to sit and contemplate seed catalogues with a view to a new season of vegetable growing. Having experienced poor cropping and indeed complete failures in recent times, I believe I should try my grandmother's belief in seed sowing under the influence of a full moon. Proponents of my grandmother's theory suggest that just as the moon's gravitational pull influences the tides, it also has an effect on soil moisture, pulling it towards the surface. Some seeds perform better when they're exposed to light, so planting during the full moon could perhaps enhance the process. Certain phases of the moon are considered conducive to planting. Moon-based planting guides suggest sowing seeds for crops that yield an above-ground harvest when the moon is waxing. Root crops, on the other hand, are best sown during a waning moon. My grandmother studied the calendar of the moon and its cycles in the pages of Old Moore's Almanac. Throughout the seasons, she made sure the book was close to hand, and I recall how dog-eared and tea-stained it became as the months progressed. She bought a fresh copy each year from a street trader in our town. Moll Daly liked to perch on the window ledge of the post office in the main street and sold, amongst other things, issues of the green-covered almanac. It was not unusual for peddlers to sell copies of the book. Back then, many considered that it brought good luck to the purchaser. The almanac was devised and published by a teacher of classics and mathematics called Theophilus Moore in Dublin in 1764. It gave details of tides and moons and was considered invaluable to both farmers and fishermen. It also made predictions of important and disastrous happenings. For example, it might foretell of wars, the death of popes, calamitous weather events, horoscopes, and remarkable as it might sound, some of these prophecies came to pass. The almanac is on sale right up to present times. Moll and my grandmother had a few things in common. Both were considered accurate soothsayers. And in the way my grandmother might augur rain, Moll was also gifted with a form of prophecy. Her husband, known as the Ducker, had developed a sideline amusement during fair days. He would crouch inside a wooden barrel. Moll sold to willing spectators rubber balls which they would throw at the Ducker whenever he popped his head out of the barrel. The Ducker was a survivor of the Great War, and a rubber ball represented little danger in comparison to bombardment.